some more stuff about iOS 15 that we haven't talked about yet. So some news since last week. iOS 15 doesn't give you access to all the RAM that you have on the device, like 8 to 16 gigabytes on the new iPad Pros. But there's a way that apps can request more than what the limit is. So tell me what that may
help. Mm-hmm. So obviously, we spoke about this before WWDC, where the new iPad Pros came out, and Procreate, especially this kind of was highlighted by Procreate update for the M1 iPad Pro, although obviously it affects any like professional, like single application that has to manage a lot of data at once. So video apps, image editors, the like. And in the Procreate case, people found that the number of layers they could have on a canvas was the same regardless of whether they had the 8 gigabyte RAM iPad Pro, which is all the base models, or if you have the 1 terabyte or 2 terabyte iPad Pro, then you get 16 gigs of RAM. But people found in the Procreate app, they weren't actually being able to use that RAM. They were only getting the same amount of layers, i.e. the available memory to the application was unchanged. And Procreate said, this is because the system limits the available RAM for us. And, you know, there's some investigation happened, and it turned out that for that M1 iPad Pro model, the limit was 5 gigabytes per app. Obviously, when you have a 16 gigabyte iPad Pro, it feels a little punitive that a single application can only access 5 gigs of, you know, that's less than a third of the total physical RAM on the system. So up to now, if you had the 16 gigabyte model, your only advantage is that more apps would stay alive in multitasking, which is a nice advantage. And in most cases, most applications don't require access to more than 5 gigs of RAM at a time. Like, you know, a blogging app, a Twitter, email, like they're much smaller footprints. But if you have like multimedia applications, you know, like a video editor, maybe like LumaFusion or something like Procreate, having access to as much RAM as possible in a single app is useful. In the Procreate case, they'll be able to offer more layers. iPadOS 15 doesn't give any more RAM by default. It's still the 5 gigabytes, but Apple has added in, or at least exposed in beta 2, a new entitlement. This is basically something that an app can add to their like signing certificate when they submit the app, and the OS reads that entitlement and it gives it different behavior. App review typically like has final say on whether a given app can use an entitlement or not. In this case, basically it means that an app can ask the system that it can take advantage of more RAM than the usual 5 gigabyte maximum. The entitlement doesn't actually work, or isn't like the code to read the entitlement and do something about it doesn't seem to be included in beta 2, so we haven't been able to find out yet like how much RAM can the, you know, can the app access all 16 gigs about as of it, or is it maybe 10 gigs or 15? You know, we don't quite know yet exactly what the technical situation will be. That'll obviously come to fruition later. But it's nice that they've actually added this for these pro cases like Procreate, which is kind of what Apple's, you know, marketing the new iPad Pro for, right? And if you're going to sell 16 RAM iPads, I don't think it's unreasonable to expect pro applications to want to be able to use all 16 gigs of it. So a nice little addition.
Yeah, you know, I think the biggest thing for me is I'm using a lot of Safari tabs with the new tabs collection feature. And to that point, I got comfortable using a keyboard shortcut. I think it's like Command Shift up or down. And if you're in one of those Safari tab collections, not if you're like in your just like your, you know, a blank window or a group of tabs without it being one of those collections, but if you're in one of those groups that you've saved as a tab collection, you can go up and down, like cycle through your tab mm-hmm. groups.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah, so I like that. So seriously, like, you know, Safari needs no entitlement, so it's beneficial there.
There were some funny memes when this was posted that it was just like the Chrome team knocked on Apple's door, like, oh, you know, classic Google Chrome RAM. Although obviously on obviously on iOS, the web rendering engine is the same because App only lets people use WebKit, so it doesn't actually make a difference there. But yeah.
Yeah. And speaking of iPads, there's some rumors we haven't got to discuss in the show yet, as well as some new rumors. So kick us off.
Mm-hmm. So firstly, Mark Gurman posted his first installment of his new Bloomberg newsletter.
Power on.
Obviously, you know, Mark does some great reporting at Bloomberg in normal stories, but now he's doing this newsletter as well. And in his first publication, he had a little scoop that Apple is in the like early stages. So it's not happening next year. It's not even happening the year after that. It's not even like confirmed on the roadmap. But engineers and designers are exploring iPad models, like Pro iPad models that have bigger screens. So obviously, the current iPad Pro maxes out at 12.9 inches. But this is saying that Apple is at least looking at ways that they could maybe make a 14-inch one or like a 15-inch one, you know, a bigger laptop size. Because the iPad maxes out at basically 12.9, and then you look at Apple's laptops and they go up to 16. So as the iPad becomes more capable, more powerful, especially when you now have like the Magic Keyboard accessory, which, you know, it goes a pretty far way to basically making the iPad like a laptop, essentially, in form factor. It, I don't think it's unreasonable to want an even bigger one, right?
Sorry. And I would definitely be, I mean, I would definitely try one out, you know, if I can make my iPad screen bigger. It's probably perfect right now for being, you know, it's like if you like a 13-inch MacBook Air, then the 12.9-inch iPad Pro is probably a pretty good sweet spot. But, you know, I've used the 16-inch MacBook Pro and really enjoyed that. And it's not so much bigger that it isn't portable. And in terms of being like on the go, that's your biggest screen you have access to. And that's really helpful. And, you know, especially if you're going to have a future of iPad OS where you can have more than split screen and slide over for apps on the screen, if you could have actual floating windows in the style of QuickNote, that would be really cool. And the more screenless that you have, the easier and more flexible that is. So probably like, you know, I could see it being timed with an OS that they like that if they were to get there, especially given that it's not, you know, next year, you know, kind of thing. So
they'll give you triple split screen with the new iPad Pro.
They'll create a new 4-column view.
Yeah.
For sideways.
Because I mean, like the Magic Keyboard accessory, it kind of, you know, recommends almost a use case where you just leave the Magic, when you're at home at least, you just leave the Magic Keyboard sitting there, you pick up your iPad from it when you want to take it around the house, and when you don't, you just want to use it at a desk, you just snap it back on magnetically and use it, you know, almost like a display at your desk, right? And so for people that do that kind of thing a lot, they probably want bigger screen versus, you know, ultimate portability options. And
yeah, and the price can be like Mac priced, because they're already, you know, looking at Mac prices.
We're already at Mac prices, yeah.
Exactly. And so it can be Mac priced, and it can maybe have you know, a chip that is in, maybe it won't be the M1, you know, at that point, maybe it would be, you know, the Macs are on like M3 equivalent or M4 equivalent, and it's an M3 or M4, you know, like just in the way that right now we're at parity with iPad and iPad Pro and Mac. But of course we expect there to be a new Mac chip soon and not to be a new iPad soon. So, if it were that the one that the really powerful Macs get was in this version of the iPad, that would be very cool. And also you can call it iPad Pro Max, like the iPhone.
Yeah. And obviously this is not like coming anytime soon. It's in, you know, early development stuff, and they are nearer term. There's clearly software things that Apple could do to, you know, bridge the gap here, like making external displays work better, right? Rather than having, you know, a third of the screen taken up by black bars, they could fix that, let you have multiple windows on the external display, let you actually do touch interactions or, you know, keyboard and mouse interactions on the external display apps. But this is, you know, the long road of hardware. So going 3 years down the line, it doesn't seem crazy that Apple would make a 16-inch iPad Pro, for instance. Even if like in by that time the screen bezels would get even smaller still, right? Like I think I know people are like, oh, I need a little border to be able to put my fingers, but I think they could easily do designs where like the whole thing is just a screen, and at that point you're probably getting to 14 inches just with the current chassis size, right? Like, and so it's not making the iPad that much bigger to get to like 15-16 inch screens, and you are getting a lot of productivity in return for that slightly extra, you know, physical size.
Maybe by then we move from micro LED to OLED. I don't know if that would be a space savings, but
well, there's actually a rumor about that this week. I don't know if that was your incredible segue or you just weren't aware, but
it was my incredible segue.
the ELEC, which is a Korean publication, they said that there's going to be a 10.8 inch OLED iPad next year, which is, and 10.8 inch is basically the iPad Air size, right? So the iPad Air. And then in 2023, Apple's going to do 11 inch and 12.9 inch OLEDs as well for iPad specifically. We think the 10.8 inch one is probably like the cheaper low end iPad Air because, well, for a start, that's what Ming-Chi Kuo said a few months ago. And the Elect says that the OLED like display structure that will be used on that model is a cheaper variant than what would be used on the iPad Pro sizes in the year after. So the 10.8 inch one would get a rigid OLED structure, whereas the 2023 ones would be flexible OLED. And it's not like the screen's actually bendable or anything, but it's just the internal components can flex around. And obviously Apple has done this to great effect with all of the iPhones that have been OLED, by, you know, they curve the bottom of the screen under, so they get that thinner bottom bezel essentially and can cut the chin out that way. And that's basically what the Elect was saying here, is that for the flexible iPads, for the flexible OLED iPads, Apple will be able to achieve thinner bezel designs than what they can currently, or what will be possible with the 10.8 inch one.
Yeah.
I mean, it's kind of weird that we're already talking about another screen technology transition for the iPads when literally right now Apple only just shipped the mini LED one. But I mean, I guess that's just the course of progress. It's normally Apple like sticks with screen technologies for a while. So I don't think we've fully got the full picture here. But, you know, as we've spoken about, mini LED isn't perfect, OLED isn't perfect. So perhaps by 2023, the cost of doing an OLED display at 12.9 inches is sufficient for Apple to adopt it, right? And then maybe the mini LED technology just gets pushed down the line. So like the cheaper iPads, like the 329 iPad, maybe gets a mini LED display while the new high-end iPads have gone to OLED or something.
Mm-hmm.
And then also from Mark Gurman, there was a more near-term iPad rumor, which is next year, so 2022. The new iPad Pro is apparently going to get a new chassis design that's going to replace the aluminium back with glass, and the glass would support wireless charging, and moreover, it would support reverse wireless charging, so a user would be able to place their AirPods case or maybe an iPhone on the back of the iPad and charge the device from the iPad's battery. So this is like exactly what was rumored for the iPhone 11, right? And then never actually happened, but apparently Apple's working on it for the next iPad Pro.
Yeah, and there's, of course, a much bigger battery in the iPad to spare for an iPhone or some AirPods. I don't remember the Elect, because that you mentioned it was a Korean site. Is that a site we've covered before?
Yeah, we have covered them before. I think they have, like, decent record of that. They're kind of like Digitimes, I think, you know, but Korean.
Mm. Yeah, I like the site names that have, like, V and then their name, because it sounds like a band, like the Elect. The information wouldn't be a very good one, but it could be a band name. The Verifier.
The Verifier, which has a good track record. You can't verify.
Yeah. Because it's like The Cure or like The Ramones or something, like The something.
Yeah. What do you think about having a glass-backed iPad?
It sounds dangerous, but of course, so is the front of the iPad. So, you know, if it's for wireless charging, that's cool. I wonder if it would be even, you know, you remember the iPhone 5 design on the back where it was like glass, but, you know, it had it was like little glass panels, the top and bottom as like,
yeah, it was like an aluminium middle and then the glass bits above and below. Yeah.
I could see like an iPhone size charging pad on the back of it, but the rest of it being aluminum.
I mean, you keep your, when you're like out and about, your iPad's in a case anyway, right?
I don't think you can call the Magic Keyboard a case. Like, if you drop it, it's not protected. Like, it's going to snap apart. Yeah. My backpack is the case. And then my hands are the case.
I haven't got a Magic Keyboard, but if you've got the Magic Keyboard closed and you drop it, it's going to open up.
Yeah.
Okay.
Have you ever dropped your AirPods with the AirPods inside?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Like usually they become three different things to locate because.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm not going to test it right now, but I think I'm confident that if you drop your iPad in like an accidental way with velocity and everything, that the iPad's going to, you know, shift out of the case.
I have always just imagined the Magic Keyboard being more secure than that. But.
Well, remember before anyone had it, we imagined a lot of things like the viewing angle to be a lot, you know, easier, like more forgiving than it is.
Mm-hmm.
And also like the fact that the way that you snap it in, it's like it pulls into the iPad versus the iPad like pulling into it. And so you know, we before it was out, you know, before I'd use it at least, like we kind of envision this, it could be like a dock where, you know, it sits on your desk and then you pull the iPad off of it and you don't have to hold down the Magic Keyboard part, but you certainly do. So I think that there's a lot of things that, that like are, I would be ideal about the Magic Keyboard case, but
it's not quite there.
Yeah, it's not quite there.
Well, hopefully when they do the glass backed iPad Pro, they also have a more protective case to go along with it that can work.
Yeah.
That can work with it.
Yeah. And now I did ask Mark Arman on Instagram, we go way back to 2013, when he was putting Power On, his newsletter at Bloomberg. I said, can I be in your band? Because to me, Power On looked like his artwork from Bloomberg. You know, they've got the amazing art department. It always comes up with something, I think like my sister would say extra. And he said, yes, with 3 exclamation points in that. And he said, I love that. So we're going to be in a band. It's called Power On.
I'll look for that. I'll look for that in his next newsletter announcement.
Yes.
He does baseball, Apple rumors, and his new band.
It's basketball. Get it right.
So sorry. I'm not American enough. Happy Hour this week is sponsored by Walter. Walter Pro for Mac makes it super easy to transfer almost any file in any format to your iPhone, iPad, and even an iPod. Walter Pro is the third iteration of the popular Walter app. That's spelled W-A-L-T-R. It's designed to make it easy to get any file from your computer onto an iOS device. It can work over Wi-Fi or USB, and it even supports legacy iPods going all the way back to the iPod Classic, the first one that was released in 2001. Using drag and drop interface, you can move photos, video, and music off your computer and into your device. Walter Pro is a useful alternative to iTunes, or whatever you call that, like built-in Finder UI now, for getting content from a Mac or PC onto your iOS device. The new Pro version of Walter lets you manually edit metadata, add cover art, convert files into Apple-friendly file formats directly on your local drive, and then it makes it super simple to push those files into third-party app sandboxes that you love the most. So you're not just putting them into the Files app, you can put them into the actual sandboxes, the containers that are used by your third-party apps. And if you happen to have a HomePod, you can convert unsupported music formats like WAV into something that can be ingested into the Apple Music Cloud Library, making it available for playback on the HomePod and the HomePod Mini. You can learn more about Walter Pro and download it for free at softareno.com/happyhour, and you can get 30% off the full paid version just for being a Happy Hour listener. Once again, that's softareno.com/happyhour, softareno.com/happyhour. Thanks to Walter Pro for sponsoring the show.
Thank you, Walter Pro. So I'm working on a thing, an article I'm going to post to either this week or next week, but it's basically a decade of selfies. I was looking back in my photo library, and if you look in photos by recent and go, you know, tap the top of the screen, it'll go all the way to the top to your oldest pictures. And recent is categorized by like when they were taken, whereas all photos is just categorized by like what the timestamp on the photo is versus like when it was added to your library. And so in recent, I was looking and like my first few photos are, it's kind of cool. Like they're from my iPhone. And because even if I added in photos that were older than that, they weren't taken on the phone before that. They weren't added to my library before that. So My photo library begins with the iPhone, and the first like few photos, like the very first photo is a selfie because it was the iPhone 4. It was the white model that came out like 10 months after it was announced, and I bought
it. Speaking of glass back devices, that was the OG.
Yeah. I think it came out on April 29th.
That sounds about right, yeah.
Yeah, April 28th, and then I bought it on May 4th. So
that's 9 months after the iPhone 4 came out.
Yeah, yeah, in black. Which is where we get the great line from Steve Jobs about the iPad 2, that white will ship on day one. So that was my first iPhone, was iPhone 4. And that was the first iPhone with a front-facing camera because, you know, it was introduced along with FaceTime video calling, which is only on Wi-Fi. So you had the front-facing camera. I think the resolution is like 640 by 480. So it's not high resolution, especially with the iPhone 4 camera on the backside. It was like the first one that was really pretty good. And so the front-facing camera, a lot less quality. But, you know, if you're taking a picture of like you and yourself, like it's what a selfie is what that camera did outside of video calling. And it made me like look back and like, okay, well, that was, you know, for me 10 years ago, at most it's like almost 11 years ago. And so I look back at I recall Apple not having used the word selfie in the iPhone 4 keynote at all, mm-hmm. nor in the iPhone 4S keynote at all. And I think it was Craig Federighi, maybe, or Phil Schiller or somebody, demoing the iPhone 5. It was the first time they said, like, take a selfie. So that would have been 2010, 2011, 2012, which is what I found in looking at this, like when selfie became a viral word that is canonical enough now that we have an album in our photo library that Apple puts there for you that finds front-facing camera photos and it's called selfies. So that made me think like, oh, we really have like a decade of selfies. You know, they might have said self-portrait before, but the shorthand, you know, that's popularized now wasn't used for a couple of years. There is one use of the word selfie that goes back to 2003 that can be found on the internet. So who knows before the internet, but in 2003 there were blogs. And there's a blog listing, a blog post of a drunken Australian man who posted a photo and apologized for it being blurry because he said it was a selfie. And so that's 2003. Then you go to 2010, you get the iPhone 4 with a front-facing camera, 4S, same deal, 2011. In 2012, I think you get the first mention of selfie at an Apple keynote. And in 2013, I believe Oxford names it as like the word of the year. So because it's so new and viral then that it becomes the word of the year in 2013.
Because people would take photos front facing, right, before like the iPhone did it, because they would just turn their iPhone backwards and you basically get like the selfie look, but looking from behind, right?
You couldn't preview it, right? There were cameras at the time, like Samsung made one, I think, that had a viewfinder on the front. So you could take a picture of yourself, you know, like it was a tiny little screen on the front compared to the backside, but it was for front facing or self portrait photos.
Yeah. I guess people just didn't call them selfies when they, you know, contorted their hand backwards to take it.
Right.
Yeah.
So I all of that was like accidental. I went down a rabbit hole. But my bigger takeaway besides like, you know, 10 years and the origin of selfie and everything was, that if I look back in 10 years of photos, which is a pretty big collection, I think my collection is you know, like 50,000 photos and videos collectively. A lot of the pictures that are of family with me are selfies because I'm the one taking the photos most of the time, unless we do like the rare occasion for a holiday and we set up a tripod and we do a timer. But other than that, you know, it's asking a stranger to take your picture together. Like, you know, people do that. You know, I do that for people, but I don't know if I've ever asked a person to like take a picture of me and someone somewhere. It's always the selfie. And so, I just had that appreciation of, you know, that I would not be in as many family photos if not for that feature. And also that the first few were taken with my brother, my older brother, who I've discussed recently. And, it's really a neat memory because the weekend, when the iPhone 4 came out, I was moving out of state and I was on a regional carrier. So I needed to get an iPhone on a national plan without roaming charges. And so that was when I first started using AT&T. iPhone 4 came out in Hawaii. So I bought that one. And, me and him raced to Best Buy out of town because it was like the one that had the white iPhone 4. And we got there about 15 minutes before they closed. And, you know, after like kind of racing there and got set up and everything. And then the first picture I took on the iPhone 4 was at 9:20 PM. It was from the front facing camera, me and my brother. And, it just reminded me of like, that makes perfect sense. It was 20 minutes after they closed that I was set up enough on the phone that I could take a picture of me and him. And then we went to the beach that night. And there's one picture of me that I took probably just inherently, you know, by habit of me at the beach from the front facing camera, and my eyes are red from the flash. And like, I couldn't see myself to preview it. And it just was not a good picture. And the next one is a selfie. And it's like, you pose for it, you know what to do, because you can see what it's going to look like before. So, I spent most of my time looking and kind of reminiscing from those 2010 photos, but the bigger takeaways throughout the years, I've been in more family photos or photos with friends, even, you know, in cool places. And then the last thing I mentioned in the piece coming soon is that before the iPhone 4, I did take photos in the style of selfies, you know, with friends and family, but it was in photo booth for my MacBook Pro.
I go, know what? I haven't thought about photo booth in so long. I've just remembered it even exists.
Yeah. So it was in photo booth, but I have a lot of photos that were started in photo booth and were moved into my photo library manually. But it was from around my college dorm hall or like, you know, Christmas holidays or something where it was like, let's all take a picture here. and so there was just, you know, couldn't be in as many locations as the phone in your pocket can be. So it wasn't as popular as the common selfie we now know. But it's a fun walk down memory lane. And I imagine some listeners have always known selfies and always had cameras with front facing cameras. So, but there was a time before, and there's just photo booth or bust. So that's something that, you know, I was really interested in. And then the other thing is, remember a while ago on this show, I mentioned Apple School Radio on Apple Music.
Mm-hmm.
It's on Apple School Radio Hits. It's Mark Hoppus, the bass player for Blink-182 and vocalist. And he has a panel, and every week they have a new themed episode. So they make a playlist together as a group. And they've got a guest, and they usually frame the playlist around the guest. So, like, I think a couple of weeks ago, the guest was the host of BBC One, not Zane Lowe from before, but whoever's replaced him now. And so the playlist was made by everybody, but it was all UK artists, for example. And I wrote a piece about how that was making me discover new music more than like playlist generation and that kind of thing. And that's still true. The thing I wanted to mention this week is that last week there was kind of a surprise announcement that Mark Hoppus, the host of that, has cancer, and it's like you don't know what's going to happen. He's said it's been for I think a few months now, and he's been going to chemo and lost his hair and everything, and this is really sad because it's like he's like, I'm scared, I don't know what's going to happen. And there was an episode released this week. I haven't listened to it yet, but I believe it talks about the situation. So I'm eager to hear that more. But that was one of those moments where I've been a Blink-182 fan since I was 10. And it was like as if a friend or family member, you know, said, you know, hey, I have cancer. And it really like hit me in a way that was unexpected, I think. Even as just like a person story that, you know, a band has to pause, go on hiatus because of COVID-19 affecting the world for a year and a half, almost 2 years. And, you know, during that period, there's no touring. And then I think they worked on an album. They were about 80% finished with the album, and they were going to complete that, you know, post COVID, when they can be in person again, and then tour after that. And then because, you know, the situation is like right after COVID is over, you know, after vaccines are distributed in the US, he finds out he has cancer, and he's, you know, taking chemo treatments, and he's not feeling good about it, you know? I wanted to mention that, like, I'm astonished that he's been doing these episodes every week.
Mm-hmm.
While undergoing chemo, because it's rough. I was a caretaker for my grandma when she had cancer, and it was really, really hard for her. And he's been doing these episodes all along, and you know, we didn't know. And then to find out that like yesterday's episode is post that announcement on Friday, you know, or Thursday or stuff. So it's really it makes them even more sentimental and special to me that they're still happening. So thoughts to Mark Hoppus and that. That's true.
Yeah, for sure. Music. And you still can't follow the show in Apple Music because they're stupid. That's a separate topic.
You can't. It moved from like 2 p.m. my time to 7 p.m. my time on Tuesdays is when it airs live. And the live is for free. On demand required Apple Music, you know, subscription, which I have, but I like to listen to it live, even though it's recorded, you know, a few days ahead of time. it's kind of, I put it on my calendar, and it feels like the old days, I guess. Anything. And then lastly, in this category of things that I want to talk about, Apple Arcade. I think this is a bug, but I have two kids. I have Apple Arcade through the Apple One Premier Bundle. My daughter's 8. She plays some games on her iPhone and iPad, but she does a lot of other things that my 3-year-old son, almost 4, hasn't gotten into yet. And he's just now getting into video games in a big way. And Arcade has been so good because he'll show me a game that he wants. It has in-app purchases. And I'm like, we're not going to get that one. But I just tell him, you know, go to the App Store, look for the joystick tab. That's Arcade. You can get any of those games for free. They're not going to have ads. So. You're not getting
and then okay, so yeah,
right, exactly. And we do family sharing so that we can avoid accidental subscriptions and buying apps with free trials that end up being $8 a week subscriptions. And I get the alert on my iPhone or iPad to approve whenever they ask to download an app, whether it's purchase or free, an app purchase or not, Arcade or not. And I hit approve if it's okay. I often hit decline because it is a free app with a free trial for 7 days, and then it's $10 a week after that, and it does nothing. So those are the ones that are this is really good against, and that are bad subscriptions. So, you know, targeting kids and everything. But in the last week of my son, you know, basically trying every game for 10 minutes and wanting to download another one and kind of just seeing what he likes, I've had to approve a lot of his requests. And the workflow has been, he hits ask and I hit approve. And then Arcade has a special UI where it's like a kind of a card comes up with the game and some nice UI around it. And so he has to hit back, which removes him from like that game. And then he has to find it again and then tap ask or get again. And then it downloads. So it's like a 5-step process all in all. And I asked people on Twitter, and I asked, you know, you what your experience was like. And what's supposed to happen is that, you know, the child taps get and then ask, and then the parent approves or declines, and then it downloads if approved automatically. Mm-hmm. And that hasn't been the case on my son's device. And I tested on my daughter's device, and it has been the case with hers. Hers just downloads right after that. And I had some feedback that, you know, sometimes it can be related to automatic downloads, which is the thing where if you download an iPhone app and there's an iPad version, you get both at the same time without manually adding it to your iPad. I've heard feedback that app Arcade games are doing this as a bug or by design. Don't know, but I think a bug. And non-Arcade apps don't do it. They download automatically. And so that's been what my experience has been, is Arcade's affected, non-Arcade games, which are more problematic, are not affected. So I don't, you know, I think it's a bug. I kind of want to just greenlight Arcade. I want to be able to say, Arcade good.
Mm-hmm.
Don't even ask me.
Yep.
Anything else, ask me, of course. So.
Yeah, like, we have Alistair by in our family as well, and I approve stuff, and I'm pretty sure it always downloads, you know, on acceptance, essentially, because on the kid's device, it says, Benjamin has approved your request, and then the app starts downloading on the home screen. So, yeah, the bug should definitely be sorted out, because that's just annoying. But beyond the bugs, I agree with you. That it'd be nice if Alistair by, which is like the official name for this feature, had a bit more granularity in, like, whitelisting stuff. So, one option would be like, if it's on Apple Arcade, just let people buy it and so just let people download it and sell it with no questions asked. But if you're talking about like the App Store at large, I've always kind of wanted a setting which is like, don't ask to buy for free apps, only ask to buy for either like subscriptions or paid apps up front. So if the app that the kid's trying to download doesn't have any cost attached to it, just let them go on and do it, right? Because, you know, some people have asked to buy because they want to like moderate the content that's being downloaded. But most people, I think, just want to make sure that the kid isn't actually downloading something that's going to charge them, right? So, and that's certainly in my situation. We have like parental controls and age limit set and stuff, but the asked to buy is there just to make sure that she doesn't actually accidentally buy something that's going to start charging us $10 a week or $5 a thing. Like, she can't read, so she doesn't know what she's clicking on, right? But all the free stuff, including all the stuff in Apple Arcade, you know, I have no problem with her getting. It's just a pain because every time she has to say ask and then I have to press accept And then I have to always go through the mental load of actually reading the dialogue just to make sure that it is actually a free app and not one that you have to buy, right? Because sometimes I'm scared that I'm going to approve something that actually is paid for. It's just I've got into the habit of always approving without actually reading it. Because so you have to go through that. And then sometimes on my Mac, on my phone, it does it with Face ID. On my Mac, sometimes it would do a Touch ID, but most of the time it wants me to enter my Apple ID password to approve the request, which is annoying as well. That's like a separate issue. So yeah, if they could just simplify it so you could have Ask to Buy on, but only Ask to Buy for paid apps and in-app purchases, essentially, because that would cover, you know, Apple Arcade then wouldn't count as a paid application because it's just, you know, you're just getting it. So anything with a get button, just let them get it without having to include the Ask to Buy approval process.
Yeah, indeed.
Happy Hour this week is also brought to you by Headspace. Why not start a new routine of mindfulness and meditation? Headspace is here to help. Headspace sessions can reduce stress, improve sleep, and boost your focus and sense of well-being. The Headspace app offers easy-to-access guided meditations, and they are one of the only meditation apps that are advancing the field of mindfulness with clinically validated research. Headspace is backed by 25 published studies on its benefits, with more than 600,000 five-star reviews and 60 million downloads to date. It has sessions for every situation, and it really can help you feel better. If you're feeling overwhelmed, well, there's a three-minute SOS meditation for you. If you need some help falling asleep, you could try out the specific wind down and relaxation sessions. And if you're a parent with kids, you can even choose meditations that are designed to get the whole family involved in the morning routine. I signed up on their website and they do a really nice job of guiding you into the world of meditation. It's nicely designed and it's super easy to get started. When you make an account, they ask if you're new to the whole kind of meditation scene, if you've done it before or not. And if you are new, it will show you some like basic starter packs that sessions that aren't too long, so you can just kind of get in and try it out and relax. And of course, once you've got an account, you can use Headspace on iPhone, Android, and on the web. Headspace makes it easy for you to build a life-changing meditation practice anytime and anywhere. You deserve to feel happier. Headspace can help make that happen. Headspace is meditation made simple. Go to headspace.com/Mac. That's headspace.com/Mac for a free 1 month trial with access to Headspace's full library of meditations for every situation. This is the best deal offered right now. So go now to headspace.com/Mac today.
Hey, next up is an Apple Watch story. This week, there was a new Apple Watch product released. I think like 18 of them or so. The International Watch Bands. They're here to celebrate the Olympics. So each country that participates in the Olympics has an Apple Watch band. They're available to order worldwide, I believe. Mm-hmm. And they are sport loop bands. So they're not the sport band. They're not the solo sport loop. They're the stretchy sort of loop and hook, you know, Velcro band. And they've got a bunch of different colors based on the country's flag. And what's interesting here is that anyone can buy them because in 2016 in Brazil, Apple had these special watch bands for purchase, but it was only in Brazil where the Olympics were being held and not online and not in other countries besides Brazil where the Olympics were being held. And so now it's available for everybody. And they also have the watch face stripes. So they do what they did with the Pride face. They put a QR code on the box for the packaging. You scan that, and it's an app clip for you to get the watch face to flat, because those are kind of hard to make. And so you get it puts on your watch based on the flag that you have. And they're available to purchase, so it's pretty cool.
Yeah, like as you say, the stripes phase is tedious. Let's put it like, if you want actually a complicated pattern, you have to like go step by step, pick the number of stripes you need, pick the rotation, then for each stripe you tap on it and you have to change the color and set it and move along. So the fact that you can just go on the website and download these configurations that Apple set up is, you know, really, really, really nice. Even if you're not going to buy the actual dedicated sport loop bands, you can just get the faces to support your team. And like, Apple doesn't actually say anywhere in this article that this is for the Olympics, but obviously this is for the Olympics, right? And I'm sure they probably wanted to announce this at like WWDC, but they, because the Olympics was kind of touch and go this year, you know, after being cancelled completely last year, they wanted to wait a few more weeks just to make doubly sure that the Olympics is actually going ahead. And who knows, probably these bands were, you know, prepared last year too, and they just couldn't release them because the Olympics didn't happen. One thing that was interesting last year is our colleague Felipe Esposito, he found evidence that Apple was working on this flags phase last year, right before any of this was official. And at least in those mock-ups that we did last year, it wasn't a stripes face, because the stripes face you can just use generically, right? You can just do any pattern that you want, and you pick a number of stripes, you pick an angle, and then you pick the colors. The mock-up from last year, based on the code findings, was like an actual flags face. And I know the stripes are nice and stuff, but I kind of wanted an actual flag face, because then you'd get like more variety in the design. So like, the America face, it uses the America colors, but you don't get like the stars of the American flag or anything. It's just confined to diagonal stripes. Similarly, with like the British face, we have like the Union Jack. That's like, you know, like a cross of diagonals. Well, you can't represent a cross on the stripes face. You can only have one angle. So Apple just goes to like the 150 degree diagonal slash with the colors in it, which is, I mean, it's fine. Like, and it's nice, but I would have really liked it if they'd done like a flags face. You know, they could have done the stripe stuff, but they would also have like the flag, the official flags face, which actually has representations of all the country's flags shaped for the Apple Watch display. Because you have other countries as well that they're not just, you know, splashes of color. Some of them have like the Japanese flag, it's like white with a red circle in the middle. Or you have some, you know, more exotic countries that have like lions and snakes and all sorts of, you know, artistry on the actual flags, and those aren't going to be represented in the stripes face. You've just got color options and a rotation, like an angle, essentially.
Yeah. One tidbit, in 2016, those were the woven nylon bands that like strap kind of NATO style. That was what they were rumored to be, you know, when that was a thing, and those went away and haven't come back, but that was a style. There was no Russia banned at the time, because Russia was banned from the Olympics for athlete doping. And so you couldn't get a Russia banned. This is the first year since then that the Olympics include Russia. So the Russia ban is all new. Otherwise, you can go back and look at our story in the previous story and compare what there is now and what they look like then. It's pretty cool. I like the Netherlands band the most, because theirs each time is orange and white in a cool way. So I think that's the coolest one.
Yeah, like you don't have to buy the bands that are relating to your own country. You could just buy the band that looks the coolest.
Yeah. And I'm looking at Apple's website where they mention, you know, where they announce these bands. And I suspect there must be to be official Olympic bands, or to like say that these are Olympic related, they would need to use the logo and pay money and partnership, you know, make the partnership. And this is
Apple doesn't have enough money for that.
Yeah, they couldn't afford it. So they say, to celebrate the indescribable drive and competitive spirit of all athletes and fans, Apple is launching the collection, this 222 limited edition bands. So that's pretty cool. I mean, so each of the countries is Australia, Belgium, Brazil, Canada, China, Denmark, France, Germany, Great Britain, Greece, Italy, Jamaica, Japan, Mexico, the Netherlands, they have the best band, New Zealand, Russia, South America, South Africa, South Korea, Spain, Sweden, and the U.S. And then they go on in the announcement to feature a former Olympic athlete. So they're really getting close to being like Olympics without saying it. It's pretty good.
Yeah, Apple loves those collaborations and partnerships. So you think they'd love to be like the official smartwatch sponsor or something of the Olympics. You know, it'd be a pretty good synergy for the Apple Watch.
Yeah.
It's kind of weird that it didn't. Maybe they tried and the Olympics didn't want any of it. Like, didn't want anything to do with it, something. You feel like whatever money the Olympics would want to be, you know, a branded partnership, it can't be more than like a few million dollars, right? Like, Apple would easily make their money back on these bands to do that. But I assume they had conversations with them and the Olympics weren't interested. So this is
maybe there's just exclusivity and they're not being asked.
Maybe Samsung's already got a deal.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's cool.
And then next up is a story on Apple and Google Cloud. What's going on here?
Mm-hmm. So obviously, Apple runs iCloud. it predominantly at least portrays the idea that it runs off all of its own data centers, and it definitely does use its own data centers to a great extent. They have the one in like North Carolina, they have one in Reno, they have like five or six all over the world, and they're currently building at least two more. These are like Apple run data centers, but Apple's need for data is so large, and like for storage is so large, that they also have to use third parties. On the content side, they rely on a lot on content delivery networks like Akamai, and for the upcoming private relay feature in Safari, we've seen them, like, they're going to have partners all over the world, including Cloudflare and stuff. So it's not like it all comes out of Apple data centers. But specifically for iCloud, Apple has always, and this isn't anything new, they've always relied on a combination of their own storage, AWS, Amazon Web Services, and Google Cloud. But what's interesting is that the Information had a report out this week that Apple's spending on Google Cloud storage has actually increased by 50% year over year. So just last year, they've essentially added 50% total cost for their Google Cloud bill. And this year, Apple will spend a total of $300 million just on Google Cloud services. There's no like security or privacy concern here at all. Apple's storing data on Google servers, but it's all encrypted and stuff. So if it's encrypted properly, it doesn't matter who owns it. It's all, it's just a pile of data until the decryption keys are available. Like in, this comes up a lot when it talks about the China relationship, right? Where the iCloud data for Chinese users is stored on servers inside of China, but Apple always says that they own the encryption keys, and so it doesn't really matter where the data is stored, it's still encrypted, right? Apple, according to the Information, manages more than 8 exabytes of total data on Google Cloud servers. One exabyte is 1 million terabytes.
Oh, 8 million terabytes.
8 million terabytes, right?
Okay.
Which sounds like a huge number, and it is a big number, but you know, when you're servicing what, like a billion accounts, a billion iCloud customers through, because they have what, like 1.5 billion active devices, about a billion active users. Like if you've got a billion users, you need a lot of storage. Like 8 exabytes is only like 4 million 2 terabyte iCloud accounts, right? Like assuming the iCloud accounts are full to the brim, and obviously a lot of 2 terabyte.
How many 5 gigabyte accounts is it?
I think it's 1.6 billion. Someone asked me this on Twitter. I didn't do that number off the top of my head. Someone asked me this on Twitter and I looked it up. Because theoretically, all the free accounts in the entire world could be stored on Google's 8 exabytes of storage. Like, it would all fit in that. But if you're looking at like the 2 terabyte plans, right, which obviously more people have access now to, thanks to Apple and Premiere, and assume that at least some amount of those 2 terabyte plans are full, well, you only need 4 million of them to use 8 exabytes. Which is kind of crazy. Apple, according to the Information, is Google's largest customer when it comes to cloud storage. The second largest is ByteDance, which is the company that owns TikTok, right?
Mm-hmm.
And while just to give you an idea of the scale, right? Apple holds 8 exabytes of data with Google Cloud. ByteDance is 500 petabytes. That's 16 times less.
Okay.
So that's a lot of data.
Cool.
And the Information basically speculates why is Apple going, you know, paying more for Google storage rather than relying on their own data centers. They couldn't get like a firm answer, but it seems basically that Apple's need for more storage is accelerating, and it's faster than they can build out their own data centers. So basically, Apple wants to use their own data centers, but they can't build them quickly enough. So while they're building the data centers, they obviously have to farm it out to third-party licensing. So via Google, they're getting the storage that they need. If they had the spare capacity, they'd probably just do it on their own servers. But, you know, it actually takes physical time and physical effort, many years to build these data centers out, right? So in that meantime, they are having to depend on Google more and more and more. It's just a cool little information. Like 8 exabytes is so much data. It's crazy. Happy Hour this week is also brought to you by She's Birdie. Whether you're walking around your neighborhood, going for a walk in the woods, running errands, or whatever, you always have to feel safe. With Birdie, you can keep doing what you love with added peace of mind. Birdie is a simple, sleek, personal safety alarm. It's designed to be easy to carry and simple to use. Carry it on your pocket or maybe in a bag or on a keychain. If you get into a situation where you're worried or concerned, it just takes one quick pull to activate the birdie. It will activate the alarm, which emits a loud 130 decibel siren and turns on a flashing strobe light to help deter an attack. And unlike something like pepper spray, birdie is no danger to you, which means you can feel confident to activate it without worry. Now, Zach, I know you got sent one of these. Hope you haven't been in a dangerous situation recently, but what do you think of the birdie?
Yeah, I was sent a number of these in various colors, and I shared them with the family. They're really colorful, which is neat, and compact, which is impressive. And the great thing here is it's a dedicated device for this. So versus something that you need to recharge or have on you all the, you know, that you might not just be able to throw in your bag or whatever, you know, then this is small and convenient. So they're really cool.
Birdie goes wherever you do. The compact alarm comes in multiple colors and a brass keychain, so it can be easily attached with your keys or a bag. Over 300,000 Birdie alarms have been sold to date with thousands of five-star reviews. So join the flock today for a safer tomorrow. She's Birdie is offering Happy Hour listeners 15% off their first purchase when you go to shesbirdie.com/happyhour. Go to shesbirdie, that's spelled shesbirdie.com/happyhour for 15% off your first purchase. Once again, that's shesbirdie.com/happyhour.
All right. Next up is iOS 15 Beta 2. This came out at the end of last recording, if you recall. And then there's since been new stuff out even today, so it's exciting. I think the most important thing out of this release, even after using the new beta versions, is that the public beta version, they call it Beta 2, but it's the first public beta version. It's available for iOS 15, iPadOS 15, et cetera. So what's different this week?
Mm-hmm. So beta 2 wasn't radically different from beta 1, which is generally how it goes. There are just some like tweaks around the maps icon that we saw at WWDC. That's now present. I think it looks nice, and it's more reminiscent of the Explore map layer that has the cool like renderings of the buildings and stuff. They very slightly tweaked the books icon, so slightly tweaked that you have to really look at it. But the spine's like slightly thinner. It looks more like a book.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. You really have to look to notice. Even though the app's completely unchanged, they like tweak the icon slightly. Offline Siri, I finally got a chance to try out this week. It wasn't working for me in the UK on beta 1. It's pretty nice. It's definitely faster for the domains where offline Siri is supported, basically. But those domains are quite limited. So like opening apps, setting timers, and then maybe like toggling system settings, like dark mode or airplane mode and stuff. Anything outside of that, it will just tell you internet connections to. If you're playing music, you can say like Siri pause or Siri play, and that does work. But if you said like Siri play music, it will go, I don't know what you're talking about. I need internet connection. So you have to like very much be in the domain of offline mode for it to actually, you know, take advantage of it. I see it mostly as a speed optimization for when you do have connectivity, but you just want to set a timer. Now it's super fast. You don't have to wait for a network round trip. So it's nice they've done it. Memoji, they've added some new clothing and outfit options. The iPad quick note feature, you can now activate with your finger, not just a pencil. And SharePlay is actually working this beta. Me and you tried it out, obviously. It works pretty well. Like you can do screen sharing. The thing where you watch like video together and the TV app's working, music we can quite get to work, but when it's all like working properly, it does seem to be presenting a pretty nice interface. So if you're like listening to music, if you're in the FaceTime call, it will say like Taylor Hall is listening to this song in this app, and you can join them in it or you can leave. You can start screen sharing session, you can ask them to join. Like it was all pretty well finessed, I would say, for you know, the first version of it actually being available.
Yeah, isn't it funny? I made a web link with a group of friends to FaceTime from iOS 15 and shared it. And a friend and so his board colleague, Jared, he accessed it from his Windows computer. And he has, what is it called? There's a system that's free that you can install to do live broadcasting and manage it and everything. I forget the name of it, but he used that on the browser that FaceTime was being used in. Mm-hmm. And he pulled off screen sharing from Windows. So
instead of sending like the webcam feed, it shows your desktop basically.
Yes.
Ah, yeah. Okay. That's clever.
Yeah. So I'll come up with the name of that and put it in show notes. And Noah, editor Seth, is just screaming it because this is one of like his things that he has used in the past a lot. So anyway, but yeah, that was a really fun experience. Eventually it broke. Just the fact that everyone was clicking on a link, like the call failed eventually, like it did in our testing. We broke it with too much testing, but yeah. You just try again.
It was pretty good for a first beta, basically, though.
Yeah, the thing that was really smooth was TV. You know, you begin a show, you scrub through it, all of it happens in real time. I changed playback to 2x. You're curious what happened and then realize what happened. You're the picture in picture. You know, your face from FaceTime is you know, in the corner, very tucked away, so that in the video. And then I can go to the home screen and browse, and you're faces within the video picture in picture, so it's pretty, you know, deep down there. And starts and stops, you know, as you control it. You kind of got to opt in each time to it if you're being asked to see something someone's sharing. And it works well. Looking forward to it being out of beta, but for now, you know, in terms of what's coming, it's a really good preview.
Mm-hmm. And then finally, WatchOS 8 beta 2 brought with it the portrait photos watch face.
Yeah, I was so happy about this to try it out, and I was not disappointed. It's a really pleasant watch face. I call it delightful in my sort of short review of it. It's neat because, you know, it's the iPhone 7 Plus that introduced portrait mode, and that was a long time ago, like 2016 or so, and so it's been a while. You probably have a lot of photos that are portrait photos at this point. And I had like 700 to choose from, of course, to take a lot of pictures. And they really do look better as a watch face to me than just any ordinary photo, even without considering the new watch face style options for the clock and location of the clock and everything. So I really like it. I think what it is because of the depth there that you don't necessarily have in other photos, it makes the subject pop even more. And that works out really well. It's like it's just really charming. I really like it. Each time you change your, you know, you lower your wrist, raise it up, or check the time, it goes to a new picture. Works in always on mode, of course. So there's a dimmed version of it with the time showing, and then you raise your wrist, and the subject sort of animates, comes, you know, a little really subtle animation as it lights up, and you can spin the digital crown to make the subject pop even more. For most photos, it didn't do the thing where it has the clock partially behind the clock, partially behind the subject. It has the clock, you know, above or below the subject. But in the ones that automatically did it, it's cool. I mean, it does hide the time in some ways that you might be too aggressive, but you can play with it on the watch app and you know, kind of do precise placement of how you want it to be. And it makes those that do have that kind of, you know, the clock hidden, makes them feel really neat. And the other ones, I think, are still look really good. And it reminded me that remember when the emoji face came out last year? What I was interested in about it was not some emoji, but that it was the first time that there was a new watch face style in that the clock was top centered instead of.
Oh, yeah. I remember now. Yeah. I remember us talking about that. Yeah.
Yep. And this is the second face to do that, because that's what happens is it's top centered or bottom centered, but it's not off to the right, not off to the, you know, bottom right or top up right. And it's way bolder than just like the very faint lined font of the photo's face. You know, on the photo's face, it can be easier because it's any face any photo you acquire that you've taken. However, if it's a live photo, it sort of plays through the video, you know, the video portion of that as you raise your wrist for a cool animation. But that was introduced in WatchOS 2, and it was shown at the original Watch keynote, and it has not been, you know, stylized to be updated in a way that this new face is designed, that, you know, with many, many years of experience of watch faces. And I think it's just the time part of it. There's three options for the clock style, and I think each of them are just really nice. They're all very bold, which I appreciate. And I've actually been using this watch face for a number of days, and I kind of, like, in my head, I call it my family and friends watch face, but it's like all things that I'm fond of. You know, I even included my late grandma in one of the photos. I would not make my watch face like just a picture of my grandma, or I couldn't choose between my two kids. It had to be a picture of both of them. Mm-hmm. But because, you know, you got the 24 pictures, when it's like one of the 24 that it cycles through, every time I see it, I'm like, oh, that's cool. You know, oh, that's nice. So it's a really, really neat thing. I posted some example photos of it. Our colleagues did as well. So that there's more examples on 95 Mac, but it's a win for me. I like it.
Yeah, I agree. It's really nice. The only funky thing about it is that it's like the first Apple Watch face where you have to configure it from the Watch app, the companion app on the iPhone. You can't do it on the Watch itself. Because I think what happens is the iPhone, when you select the photos through the Watch app, the iPhone generates like the background mask and the portrait cutout like on the iPhone. And it just sends the computed result to the Watch. And I guess the Watch isn't powerful enough to actually do that itself. Or maybe the portrait depth data isn't sent to the Watch. It just sends like flat files. It'd be nice if they could, because that does mean you have to like set it up manually a bit, whereas the photos face is a lot more accessible because you just turn it on and any photos that are sunk just start appearing there. So maybe in a future beta or maybe in like a future release, if they could just make it like, if you set the portrait face on the Watch itself, it will say like downloading or whatever, and then just automatically go and grab some portrait photos to at least get you started. And then if you wanted to go later and customize it.
Yeah, I mean, they said that the photos face is the most popular. I must mean it's easy to use. This one has a little bit more of a learning curve to it, but I think it's a way better visual watch.
Mm. Oh, yeah. Like the work to set it up is well worth it. It's really nice.
Yeah. Yeah. I agree. All right. That is the Happy Hour podcast for this week. You can follow us on Twitter. I'm on Twitter and Instagram at Apollo Zach. That's A P O L O Z A C. Benjamin, you're on Twitter at
BZA Mayo.
And you can email us at happyhour@95mac.com. Thanks to everyone who has subscribed in Apple Podcasts to the $4.99 per month ad-free tier. We really appreciate going the extra mile to support us. And we hope that you're enjoying the show ad-free. You subscribe in Apple Podcasts. And we will be back next week. Bye, everybody.
Bye-bye.